Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I was particularly excited about participating in this specific part of the program today because, for me, it exemplifies what it is about the work of the Hamilton Project that is so compelling. So with that thought in mind, let me highlight three distinctive features of the three presentations we're going to hear today. So first of all, each of the proposals has been crafted by a leading thinker within the field of economics. Secondly, each of the proposals addresses a timely and very important policy issue. And third, each of the proposals draws off some recent piece of powerful research to create a concrete, specific policy recommendation. And as Michael was saying, this sort of evidence-based policy recommendations, they're really the hallmark of the Hamilton Project, and they really continue with a long tradition of valuable work coming out of the Brookings Institution. So these are all papers, or the underlying work is they're all papers that have been through rigorous review within the scholarly community. And to be sure, they've followed kind of the natural scholarly life cycle of either being headed for or already published in top journals, and they'll have impact that way. They are already influencing the next cohort of researchers, and the ideas are being disseminated within the policymaking community. But what we're doing today is we're asking the authors to translate them now into specific proposals so that we can really have immediate impact with them. So in terms of the substance, Michael and Bob have already laid out what it is that ties these papers together. They're about what investments we can make to achieve broad-based prosperity. We have a theme in this session, and the theme is really the life cycle. So our first paper is going to be by Doug Almond, and he's going to address prenatal issues. So it's really about investments that expecting mothers can make and that we can help expecting mothers make in order so that their children will have higher well-being and be more productive later in life. Then Roland Fryer is going to wrestle with what interventions we can make with regard to children in schools and how we can help them go on to a better life and to be more productive measures of the workforce. Michael is going to tackle the existing workers and what sorts of investments that we can do for them to increase their productivity and to increase the productivity of the nation as a whole. So with that background in mind, let me turn things over to Doug Almond.
Great. Thank you very much for coming to hear these proposals today. What I'm going to talk about is the importance of the prenatal period for the later life productivity of workers. So as Roland's going to talk about some more in a few minutes, the acquisition of skills occurs throughout childhood. And economists have spent a lot of time analyzing periods in which people acquire skills that have a return on the labor market. So the attendance of a four-year college has been shown to increase wages, and the usual rates of return that are calculated are on the order of about 8% for each year of schooling. Interestingly, if you start to progress backwards through childhood to two-year college, the rates of return don't fall that much when you're considering something like a community college. Returns stay around 8%. And similarly for graduating high school, rates of return are high. Now we can continue to go further in the life cycle and think about primary schooling. In the case of primary schooling, we're not going to think so much about whether you go to primary school. But in this case, since most everyone in the United States goes to primary schooling, the question is, what's the quality of primary schooling and how does that affect wages later in life? And so there are some studies on class size that have been widely cited, finding reducing class size has substantial effects on later life earnings. And similarly, going still earlier to preschool and the Head Start program, benefits of that program accrue through the whole work life cycle. What I want to talk about today very briefly is the prenatal period. Obviously, in the prenatal period, we're not talking about schooling so much as we are about health as experienced during the prenatal period. So basically, over the last 5 or 10 years in economics, there's been a great deal of research on how health around the time of birth has persistent effects on both health in adulthood and productivity in adulthood as well. So much of this early research has linked measures of health at birth, things like birth weight, to adult labor market outcomes. So one widely cited study finds that about a 1% increase in earnings in response to a 10% increase in birth weight. So this relationship between birth outcomes and adult productivity is a very persistent and robust one. Over the last few years in economics, what's been done, I think, very carefully and in a great many different contexts, is looking at specific prenatal health events and how these trace through to later life productivity. So a set of studies looks at extreme nutritional deprivation in the prenatal period and finds that experiencing something like a famine in utero is much worse than experiencing that famine, say, at age one or age two, that the persistent effects of that deterioration in health at a critical developmental stage show up in compromised adult health, but also compromised adult productivity. In addition to sort of extreme nutritional decreases, economists have also looked at infections. So infections are something that are obviously a lot more common than famines, and looking at things like malaria, pneumonia, influenza, things like that, we find that exposure to infections in utero is particularly damaging to educational attainment, intelligence as measured by IQ, and wages. What I'm going to do now is just briefly highlight one study of mine that looks back to the 1918 influenza pandemic in the United States. So this next figure that I show plots two things. So the dotted line, which I'll ask you to look at first, is the number of deaths in the United States in 1918 and 1919. We plot the number of deaths for each quarter, so starting with the first quarter of 1918, going through the fourth quarter of 1919. What we see is the first three quarters of 1918 had essentially zero deaths to influenza. However, in the fourth quarter of 1918, we had over 200,000 deaths from influenza, so a really striking number that persisted above normal levels into the first quarter of 1919 and then basically fell back to zero. Now, while as striking as these mortality figures are, the most common experience with the 1918 influenza was not to die from it, fortunately. It was to be infected by it, get sick for a while, and then recover. And so what the 1918 pandemic provides is a natural experiment in prenatal health. So mother's health deteriorated, and then the question is, that cohort or that group of individuals that was born a few months later that happened to be in utero during the height of this influenza outbreak, how do they look later in life? So the solid line here plots the average health observed 70 years later, okay? And unfortunately, economists, health economists in particular, like to measure health backwards so that basically increases in a health index mean worse health. What we see is that the black line is fairly flat with the exception of the second quarter of 1919. If you were born in the second quarter of 1919 and therefore disproportionately exposed to the height of the influenza pandemic, that occurred 6 months earlier, your health is that much worse, observed 70 years later. These health effects extend beyond simply compromised self-reported health. Cardiovascular disease is a main reason why prenatal influenza exposure compromises health. But we also see that the productivity of this cohort is also reduced in addition to the health effect. So those exposed prenatally to the 1918 flu are 15% less likely to graduate from high school, 20% more likely to not work due to a physical disability, and their wages are 5 to 9% lower. So circling back to the original estimates, this reduction in productivity that occurs from influenza infection is kind of similar to the return to a full year of schooling. So I'd like to make three brief policy suggestions in the spirit of this this finding that the prenatal period is especially important. One, and most obviously, is to boost influenza infection influenza vaccination rates in the United States, which are fairly low and are especially low for women of childbearing ages. Secondly, I think we can leverage existing programs to greater effect. So roughly 40% of births in the United States are covered by the WIC program. However, most of these births that are covered by the WIC program, the enrollment occurs not in the first trimester, but in the second or the third trimester. Much of this research by economists has found that the first half of pregnancy is particularly important. So if we could accelerate enrollment into WIC to be just a few months earlier in pregnancy, we could be realizing some substantial productivity gains later in life. And then finally, even if we leave aside the question of public policies that target the prenatal period, there may be low-cost things we can do to recognize pregnancies earlier in pregnancy. So most pregnancies are not recognized after the first month, and many much later. Mothers on their own usually take behavioral actions that are beneficial to fetal health. However, some of those changes in behavior may occur later than is optimal. So low-cost interventions to detect pregnancies earlier could trigger some of those behavioral responses that benefit later life productivity. Were we going to take okay. Thank you very much.
The other panelists to ask some questions to Doug, and I will take the moderator's prerogative of asking the first question. So, Doug, you know, actually, the research that you presented, actually, I find to be some of the most compelling research out there on the topic, but it does focus on fairly extreme health exposures, the 1918 pandemic, and I was just wondering if I could get you to talk a little more about whether you think this applies to less extreme exposures.
I think it does, and your question's very well taken in that certainly in the case of a famine or a flu pandemic, the policy prescription's already there that we shouldn't have them. So the question is, for less extreme events, are there things we should be doing? And indeed, the evidence, which I think is more recent than looking at these more extreme events, is quite similar in that seasonal outbreaks of flu and sort of more modest changes in nutrition during pregnancy also register surprisingly large long-term effects.
So, Doug, you know, because I called you, my wife was pregnant or is pregnant and was the first trimester was during the H1N1 period. We followed everything you said. How much more is our daughter going to earn?
Congratulations on the pregnancy.
No, seriously, how big are they? We want to get the savings right.
Right. So basically, for having avoided exposure to a relatively extreme flu outbreak, the wage effects are on the order of 5 to 9% registered throughout life. Yes. So congratulations.
Can we get it back from her?
And Roland, with some hesitation, I'm going to ask you if you have a question for Doug. That's probably just as well. Why don't we just roll into Roland's presentation then?
Okay. All right. Good morning. Thank you, Michael. Thank you to the Hamilton Project for inviting me here. I hope I don't say anything in the next 10 minutes that will cause you not to invite me back. There we go. Fantastic. I have three goals this morning. One, I want to convince you that public education in America is in trouble. In fact, I think we have a national emergency. I want to talk about that a little bit. Second, I want to give you a brief report on an innovation that we just concluded, which was paying kids incentives for doing well. I'll give you a very brief report on that. And the third thing I want to do before I leave is to convince you that in the search for solutions to our K through 12 education problem, if you don't remember anything else from whatever I say today, please do not search in the set of solutions that make adults feel comfortable. Right? I was watching this spot on TV last week, and there was a teacher who was complaining about the idea that contracts might be altered. And I believe the exact quote was, "How are we going to buy a house if we don't know if we have a job year to year?" And I thought, who does she think she is, a Harvard professor? All right, here's my brief report. Financial incentives and student achievement. This is work that's been conducted over the past few years in four U.S. cities. Here's some quick motivation. There is a large racial achievement gap in America. You've probably heard about it. The gaps arise at age two, and they're, as kids age, when they enter kindergarten, for example, the gaps are equivalent to being 8 months behind in math and 5 months behind in reading when kids enter kindergarten. Okay, when you look in the fourth and the eighth grade, the gaps have expanded since they entered kindergarten. And, you know, if you look in D.C., for example, 4.5% of black students here in Washington, D.C. are proficient in math. Okay, I didn't misplace my decimal point. 4.5%. Okay, that's crazy. 4.5%. There have been many attempts to close the gap with pretty little success. We've tried early childhood programs, and we see that can boost kindergarten readiness for sure. The gaps often fade as kids enter school. We've tried small school, smaller classroom. We tried a lot of things, and there has not been one district in the history of our country that has actually closed the achievement gap. We've made some progress, but we haven't closed the gap yet. So let's talk about student incentives. So the bottom line here is that well-designed student incentives, and I'll tell you what that means in a second, produce pretty good results at a low cost. Okay, and so I've converted the estimates per Michael's suggestion / demand into months of schooling. And here you have the cost per student for some popular programs as well. Okay, so well-designed incentives, when you run them as a randomized trial, you have a treatment control group, et cetera, they can boost achievement on the order of magnitude of about 2.2 to 3.1 months of schooling. If you look at Head Start, it's about 4. The average New York City charter school is about 1.1 months. If you reduce class size from 22 kids to 15, you get about 2.8 months. And so you can see the cost here as well. Right? So in D.C., when we ran these experiments, and I'm going to tell you what they are in a second, the average cost is about a little over $500 per kid. In Dallas, the cost was about $14 per kid. Okay? If you look at the average cost of Head Start, that's over $5,000, et cetera. So 2 minutes? Real? Wow. This is not going to well-designed incentives. These other programs are not going to close the racial achievement gap, but I can tell you that well-designed incentives certainly have a positive return on investment. Okay, so here's what we did. 260 schools in four cities. Those four cities were Chicago, Washington, D.C., New York City, and Dallas. About $10 million was distributed directly to kids, so we opened up actual bank accounts for the students. I know more about the Patriot Act than anyone should ever need to know. And we deposited the money into the bank accounts. We sent in, you know, financial literacy for the kids, et cetera. I'm not sure if it took or not because one of my kids came up to me about 3 months ago and said, "Hey, I really understand my bank account." I said, "Are you going to save?" He said, "Absolutely, I'm going to save, Professor." I said, "Well, how are you going to save?" He said, "I'm going to put my money into the bank for about a month, earn some of that interest, then I'm going to spend it." It's not perfect, but for, you know, for a fourth grader, a month is a long time. So we had second graders in Dallas. We had sixth through eighth graders here in D.C. In New York City, we had fourth and seventh graders. In Chicago, we had ninth graders. So the bottom line is, in Dallas, for example, we paid kids $2 a book to read. Okay, now don't walk out. $2 a book to read. In New York, we paid kids for their performance on test. And what we found is that when you pay kids for things like behaviors, you pay them to read books or you pay them to come to class and not have any behavioral issues that would cause disruptions in class, then you get an actual reasonably big benefit in terms of student achievement. If you just pay them for the achievement on the back end, you actually get no results. Okay? So if you pay them, in economist language, if you pay them for inputs, okay, you get good output. If you pay them for output, they get excited and look at you because they don't have no clue how to actually produce that output. Here's a quick graph to show you visually how big the effect sizes are. The line at the top, if you can see that, is the effect of lowering class size. And so you see in Dallas, the effects of our program a little larger, in D.C. a little less, in New York City and Chicago, where we paid kids for output, not very many results. Okay, quick policy implications. So the program in Dallas, the cost was about $14 per kid. We got results which were the equivalent of 3.1 months of schooling. In my sense, that's a layup. So in terms of policy implications, that's pretty clear. But more than that, I actually think that we just need more, and I hate to sound so much like an academic, we need more innovation here. We need to understand how incentives work more. A lot of folks thought that they would actually decrease kids' learning because it would crowd out their intrinsic motivation. In our results, we find no evidence of that. I think we need more time to understand the potential power and the cost effectiveness of incentives going forward.
So Roland, thank you for that really interesting presentation. You obviously talked about the need for more research in this area. I was wondering if I could just, you know, get you to talk a little more about whether, and maybe there's research been done or maybe it's just research that needs to be done. Can you talk a little more about whether you think certain categories of students are most receptive to these sorts of programs? And if so, how is it that we target those categories?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. So one thing we found was that most programs, most education programs, they kind of they benefit girls more than boys, and we found the exact opposite in the incentives. They worked more for boys than they did for girls, and they actually worked a lot more for minorities than they did for non-minorities. And the third category in which we found kind of the most powerful effects were kids who had behavior problems in the previous year to the experiment. When you actually paid them to have good behavior and to come to class and to sit still, et cetera, their test scores actually went up more than any other subgroup. So I think what's interesting about incentives to me, beyond the cost effectiveness, is the ability to hit groups that we know are incredibly hard to target.
Can I ask you, too, your results are different across cities. Of course, you're doing different things in different cities. And
sure.
I'm just curious if you think there are city-specific factors that are also getting in there and affecting the differences in results. And, you know, the reason I have this in mind is because if you're thinking about a program that you're going to apply nationally, I mean, how much confidence can we have that applying the program will actually yield positive results in all sorts of cities?
You didn't ask Doug such tough questions. There's a question toughness gap on this thing. I think we can be as confident as we can be having run kind of the first national experiment on incentives in urban education in America. So not too confident. That's why the biggest policy recommendation I have is to avoid our kind of squeamishness over the idea of paying students to learn. I know it makes you feel uncomfortable. My grandmother was a teacher for 37 years. She said, do you have to do that? Like, I get it, okay? But what we're finding is that these can have very high returns on investments if done right, and I'd like to expand them up to see if the Dallas model will work in New York City and Detroit and other places. So I think I don't know the answer to your tough question, but more experiments and more pilots will yield answers to those important questions.
Thanks. Doug, Michael, I think Roland's looking for softballs, but I encourage hard questions.
So I wanted to jump in. I think part of what Roland has touched upon, but I think is so exciting about his work, he's kind of, you know, the focus is on educational outcomes no matter how you get there. And in that spirit, I think kind of a third rail, oftentimes paying students is maybe a third rail, so maybe this is a second third rail, is incentives for parents. You know, I keep bringing up my family. As Roland knows, we have a 7-year-old son, and, you know, he doesn't always think most clearly, and it's a little bit hard to imagine that we could imply, we try to imply incentives all the time with very limited success. So, I mean, that's just for cleaning this room and things like that. But I wonder, are there any experiments on the horizon that might try and get inside the family where principal parents might have some influence on this as well?
Yes, there are. My grandmother had the first incentive program. It was called the Go Get Your Own Belt program. So, yes, in Chicago in the fall, we are going to be looking into parental incentives for teaching students, kids, what they need to learn before they go to kindergarten relative to center-based early childhood. So, you know, we spend $12,000 a year in early childhood centers. One option would be to say, hey, what if the parents could earn up to $12,000 a year if the students learned what they needed to learn going into kindergarten? So that will start in the fall. The second piece, which we're trying to start now, is I'd like to actually see an incentive. Here's a crazy idea. Take an incentive program and have student incentives, maybe teacher incentives, and parental incentives all centered around a common goal, right? So getting everyone on the actual same page to produce achievement for our children. And I'd like to see those happen. Again, I don't think they're going to be the savior of American education, of course, but they may have a positive return on investment.
Great. Why don't we go into Michael's presentation?
Okay. What I'm going to talk about is related to a topic that I think will come up later today, which is there's been, over the last several decades, there's been a long-run decline in the manufacturing sector in the United States. And one idea that's often recommended is innovation clusters. And the great thing about innovation clusters are they're incredibly difficult to define. And they kind of mean everything to everyone. And so what I have tried to do in some of my research is to operationalize what an innovation cluster is and then try and test what its impacts are. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. And so to be precise, what I'm going to, and this, you know, might rule me out from everyone else who has alternative views on innovation clusters, my view is that an innovation cluster is just when a bunch of firms locate in the same place who do roughly the same thing. And the intuition for why they might be a solution for the troubles of the manufacturing sector and general U.S. competitiveness is it's very simple. The idea is if people are located in the same place or roughly doing the same thing, there's a free flow of ideas. And if I sit next to Karen and I sit in the same building at Brookings, and by being able to sit in the same building, I might run into her in the elevator one day, and she might give me an idea, and I could write an extra academic paper, which, as we all know, has extremely high productivity for the U.S. So obvious examples of innovation clusters are the information technology collection of firms in Silicon Valley, the life sciences in Massachusetts, and in manufacturing in the Pacific Northwest. And I should mention this notion of innovation clusters and their potential usefulness and success, it's widespread. And, you know, in the United States, you often see these very aggressive bidding wars for new plants to locate in a particular place. There's a famous story of the BMW plant that I think went to South Carolina. There's a Mercedes plant in Alabama. And each of them was showered with tons and tons of incentives. And so to date, that's largely been the purview of local governments. Internationally, this has actually been the purview of central governments quite frequently. And by one calculation, 52 different countries have innovation clusters. China's on the list. Brazil's on the list. Russia's on the list. And so again, what I'm going to try to do here is talk a little bit about what do we actually know about them, and what are their impacts. So this is just drawing from some research with Enrico Moretti, who's at the University of California, Berkeley, and Richard Hornbeck, who's a colleague of Roland's at Harvard. And the idea of this study was, again, we really wanted to make this idea operational. What we're envisioning is, suppose you could just take some really big and important-seeming manufacturing plant and just drop it out of the sky somewhere. And if you're able to do that, then you're going to have an increase in activity in a very particular industry in a particular location. Now, unfortunately, the Internal Review Board at MIT wouldn't allow us to conduct that experiment. But as an alternative, there's a journal called, if you're having trouble sleeping at night, called Site Selection. It's a corporate real estate journal. And the key, one very nice feature of that magazine, for the purpose of this research, is they have an article every month called The Million Dollar Plant. And in this article, they describe how some very high-profile plant chose where to locate. And these plants, again, are often showered with, you know, many scores of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of incentives. When they begin deciding where to locate, they hire a corporate real estate consulting firm. They consider 50 counties. And they eventually winnow it down. And they keep winnowing it down. And what's revealed in these articles in Site Selection is the county that the plant actually chose and the runner-up county. And the idea is that this might approximate what we would be able to get out of an experiment. So the idea is to use the county that almost attracted the million-dollar plant and compare it to the county that was successfully won the million-dollar plant. And the question that I'm going to present some evidence on is what happens to the productivity of the guys who are already sitting there making their widgets, doing whatever it is, and then what also happened to employment. Okay, and so this is presented in this graph. So the blue, so the vertical line is shows the year before the new plant opened, and what you can see is that the difference in productivity in winning and losing counties is pretty flat. It's a little bit higher in the winning counties before the plant comes, and then when the new plant opens, there's this very sharp change in trend in productivity. And in fact, after the new plant opens, 6 years later, statistical evidence suggests that productivity among plants who are already there doing their own thing has increased by about 12%. And to put some, you know, rough or some precise, some economic meaning on that, it's the 12% increase in productivity is equivalent to increasing output, holding constant the number of workers and machines and factories by $430 million. It's really a dramatic increase in productivity. The same, and there's a very similar finding when it comes to employment. Again, there's a kind of the difference between employment and winning and losing counties in the manufacturing sector is roughly constant before the plant opens, and then after the plant opens, there's a large increase in employment in the same industry as the plant, and that increases about 9% 6 years later, 9% higher level employment. Okay. So in the spirit of Hamilton, we've got this loose concept of innovation cluster. We now have found some evidence and how to turn this into an actionable policy. So late at night, my idea was something which I've named the Federal Innovation Cluster Fund. And be careful. and the idea is, local governments know have a much better idea than the federal government of what is going to work on the ground. And the idea is to have local governments come to the federal government and say, well, this is a plant or this is an industry that we want to grow in our area. And we want to provide this level of incentives. And what one could imagine doing is our Federal Innovation Cluster Fund is providing some kind of subsidy for that. There could be a cost-sharing program where they covered 20% of the costs. An alternative version would be to pay some fixed amount per worker. And in principle, what this would allow, it would allow some of these spillovers between the new firm and the existing firms to be located in the area where they'll be largest. And so that's an example of turning research into action for Hamilton.
So thank you.
Michael, if I could just press you a little harder about your research. I mean, presume you've chosen...
be kind.
You've chosen, I think by nature, I mean, these plants, the locations these plants have already have all been covered by this industry publication, so I think that inherently means that they're high-profile cases.
Yes.
And I'm just curious about, you know, whether you have a sense of, you know, is this going to generalize when we're talking about plants that are not nearly as high-profile?
Yeah, so I think it's very unlikely that those results apply to an average plant. These are very high-profile plants where they were that engendered all this bidding to begin with. And I think the way to try and one could get policy to target them is by having this cost sharing. So the federal government would only get involved if local governments were willing to put up a certain amount of money.
And if I could just ask you one more question, I think the thing that keeps us all up at night, and I'm sure it keeps you up at night, or it was when you had your in your last position, is just that you always worry with these sorts of programs that, you know, one area is just benefiting at the expense of some other area, that it's, in a broader sense, some sort of zero-sum game. And I just, can I just get you to talk a little more about how you know that's not the case?
I think what, so our first, or most economists' first intuition for this is that these programs where you pay a plant to show up is just shifting economic activity around the country. And I think what's so important about the results I showed is it is true it's shifting economic activity, but there's also this spillover part, and it makes the other people around that plant better. And that can expand the overall size of the economy. In many respects, I think that finding kind of is a pushes back or contradicts the intuition that a lot of us have, that it's just a zero-sum game.
Great. I guess I have a question.
Sure, I have a question. So I'm not married and I don't have kids, but...
Yeah. Is your wife pregnant?
But not that I know of. but if I were and I moved next to a plant, how much could I expect to earn more?
Well, that is an incredibly easy question. The productivity I measured was in a sector that produces something. You work in academia.
Fair.
Any more questions?
There's a toughness gap.
Is that your final answer?
I think that was my final answer.
Okay. Well, so then let me come around. Let me ask you, just pose a question to all of you. I mean, Michael already, or I'm sorry, Doug, did you have questions for Michael?
No.
Okay. You know, Michael talked in his earlier presentation, you know, about the fiscal strains that the country are facing and just how incredibly tight times are in terms of the federal budget deficit. You know, how we spend the money is just, you know, critically important. So I was wondering if I could get a sense from each of you. Maybe Michael's proposal was so specific, maybe I know the answer. But Doug and Roland, what's the first dollar that you would spend, you know, in terms of putting these things into action?
So that was equally difficult. But a nice thing about a focus on the prenatal period is that many of the interventions that one would do to avoid harm are very inexpensive to do, and I think many of those are informational in the sense that if we give women information on the long-term effects of damage in utero, but also if we let them know earlier that they are pregnant, and basically providing information is cheap, so I think that's where I would start is accelerating the time at which women realize they're pregnant.
And I would put the next dollars into innovations in education. We can do incentives if you like, but there's a lot of other ideas on the table that have the potential to increase achievement and have a positive return on investment. I mean, look, the cost, and I know you've heard this a lot before, but in this case it's very, very true. The cost of doing nothing, right? If we have 4.5% of our eighth graders doing math below proficiency levels, right, the cost of doing nothing is going to be enormous. Right? We're spending $35,000 a year to incarcerate them, and there are other health costs and unemployment costs that we're bearing. So I think we invest the money up front, and we'll save it. We'll save it on the back end.
Yeah. So I think the first thing I would do is try and, as I suggested, set up a fund that a federal fund that could be used to support local efforts to attract plants. And I think there's a, one might wonder why the federal role. You know, a lot of times the benefits are out far into the future, and it can be difficult for local governments to borrow. And I would keep the, make sure that the local governments had a lot of skin in the game. I wouldn't let the cost sharing be higher than 20% or 25%. But I think, you know, to your general question, I think in, you know, given the current fiscal situation, I think what each of us have tried to do in some sense is really focus on something where there is a demonstrated payoff. And I think applying that filter to policy going forward is going to be increasingly important.
If I could just jump in on that. In terms of health expenditures in the United States, we obviously spend a great deal in the U.S. on health, but in particular towards the end of life. And so one way to sort of rephrase this in sort of the in the realities of the current fiscal context are that a reallocation of just a small part of those expenditures from end of life to early in life, so not spending any more, but targeting it earlier, could have productivity effects. So basically, it would pay for itself, this reallocation, but people would become more productive as a result.
And, you know, I think this is also one I think another common theme across this panel, which I just want to amplify what Doug is saying, is I think there will be, it's not just trying to evaluate new expenditure programs, but I think there will have to be a reevaluation of current expenditure programs and focusing the dollars where the payoff is the highest. So I've you know, someone asked me, I've known about Roland's work on this kind of even before there are any results, and someone said to me, well, you know, there's no way that, you know, you can pay kids to do anything. And I said, well, you know, right now we spend, in Cambridge, where I live, we spend $20,000 a year per student. And are you telling me that the first dollar spent on incentives isn't worth more than the $20,000 spent on class size or the $20,000 spent on whatever it is the Cambridge Public Schools spend their money on? And the answer might be no, but I think kind of reconceptualizing how we're doing our spending and looking for where the returns are, I think is going to be, it's essential going forward.
So I agree with you on that point. I think, you know, I think Doug's making an excellent point about the, I mean, I think you're all making excellent points about reallocations. I mean, I do think that then you're getting away, you know, sort of wearing your economist hat there, and if I ran the world, this is what I would do. I mean, I think there are political realities that may get in the way there for some of these ideas.
I couldn't agree more.
Other questions for you guys?
No.
Okay. Well, then I'd like to thank you very much. And thank you.